What if everything you believed about democracy, media independence, and American foreign policy was carefully constructed illusion, not through crude propaganda or explicit censorship, but through sophisticated systems that make manufactured consent feel like free thought? This is the unsettling revelation at the heart of Chomsky's work, a systematic dissection of how power operates invisibly in democratic societies, shaping reality itself while maintaining the appearance of open debate. The brilliance lies not in conspiracy theories, but in exposing institutional logic, how corporations, governments, and media organizations naturally align to surf concentrated power while genuinely believing they're independent actors. Understanding this machinery doesn't require paranoia, just willingness to examine how systems actually function rather than how they claim to function. Media manufactures reality through five filters, excluding perspectives threatening power. First, ownership. Major outlets are corporations selling audiences to advertisers, producing content reflecting corporate interests. Second, advertising dependence prevents criticism of consumer culture. Third, reliance on official sources ensures government perspectives dominate. Fourth, organized flak campaigns punish dissent through coordinated criticism. Fifth, anti-communism, now anti-terrorism, justifies conformity. These filters create indirect control without explicit censorship. Indonesia's massacre of East Timorese with American weapons received minimal coverage, while Cambodia's Pol Pot garnered extensive attention, emphasizing communist brutality. Elections in U.S. allied states face minimal scrutiny. Adversary elections receive intense criticism. The system's genius lies in invisibility. Unlike Soviet censorship, Western indoctrination operates through implicit assumptions, framing legitimate discussion. Journalists internalize constraints, advancing by demonstrating responsibility through self-censorship. This creates necessary illusions, beliefs serving power that seem self-evident. Even alternative media fosters debate's impression, while fundamental power structures remain unchallenged. Military spending isn't primarily about defense. It's about maintaining economic order while avoiding democracy. After World War II, wartime spending had ended the Depression, but continuing such intervention in peacetime risked democratizing economic power. The solution was military Keynesianism, using defense spending rather than social programs to manage the economy. As Air Force Secretary Stuart Symington explained in 1948, the word to talk was not subsidy, the word to talk was security. This framing allowed government to subsidize high-technology industries without public interference. The system proved remarkably effective. By 1958, the Defense Department funded approximately 85% of electronics research. Companies like IBM and Boeing received massive Pentagon funding, with defense contracts cross-subsidizing civilian activities. The semiconductor industry was created almost entirely through military procurement. Even the internet emerged from ARPANET, a Pentagon project. This arrangement serves multiple purposes. It justifies imperial actions abroad, controls populations through fear, and provides politically acceptable state intervention. Unlike social spending that might encourage democratic participation, military spending gives corporate managers direct gifts with minimal accountability. The classified nature of defense work further insulates these arrangements from scrutiny. The Strategic Defense Initiative functioned primarily as technology development, with 80% of its $26 billion budget flowing to private industry. Political language operates through dual meanings, dictionary definitions, versus propaganda-loaded ones. Terrorism applies only to enemies' actions, while identical behavior by allies becomes counterterrorism or security operations. The War Department's transformation into the Defense Department exemplifies how defense justifies even aggressive military actions. Most revealing is moderate, meaning simply follows U.S. orders. This label applied to Morocco's King Hassan, Saudi Arabia's royal family, and Indonesia's Suharto, who slaughtered 500,000 people in a U.S.-backed 1965 coup that American media celebrated as a gleam of light in Asia. Egypt's Hosni Mubarak remained moderate despite decades of authoritarianism, while democratically elected leaders opposing U.S. policies were branded radical. Peace process perfectly illustrates this manipulation. A New York Times analysis showed 100% usage supporting whatever the U.S. is doing, despite America blocking major peace initiatives. These distortions represent what Orwell called defense of the indefensible. By controlling language, power structures control thought itself. Media outlets reinforce these patterns through repetition, creating manufactured consent. As Chomsky explains, the smart way to keep people passive and obedient is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within that spectrum. The standard narrative of American foreign policy, defending freedom against totalitarianism, crumbles under historical examination. Declassified documents reveal America's primary concern isn't opposing left-wing governments, but preventing economic independence. As global hegemon, the U.S. ensures third-world countries provide markets, resources, and cheap labor for American business interests. This explains routine overthrows of democracies while supporting brutal dictatorships. In 1953, the CIA toppled Iran's democratic government under Mohammad Mossadegh for nationalizing oil from British Petroleum, installing the Shah's 26-year dictatorship. Guatemala's Jacobo Arbenz fell in 1954 for land reforms threatening United Fruit Company. The classic technique involves arming a country's military while making civilian governments impossible through economic warfare. In Chile, the U.S. armed the military and created economic chaos, Nixon's Make the Economy Scream, until they overthrew Salvador Allende in 1973. Kissinger's blunt assessment, "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people." Operation Mongoose reveals the pattern. Kennedy's massive terrorist campaign against Cuba involved bombing civilians, contaminating exports, and assassination attempts. The U.S. decided to overthrow Castro in March 1960, before significant Soviet involvement, proving the issue was Cuban independence, not communism. Areas under greatest U.S. control suffer worse outcomes. Central America remains plagued by poverty after decades of U.S.-backed dictatorships. Meanwhile, countries that developed economically, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, either avoided colonization or used protectionist policies the U.S. actively prevents Latin America from implementing. Democracy faces a fundamental challenge. Concentrated private wealth forces governments to prioritize keeping the rich happy or face capital flight and economic collapse. When reform candidates win elections, investors withdraw capital, triggering currency crashes that override democratic mandates. Greece's 2015 experience starkly illustrated this. Voter rejection of austerity was effectively overruled by financial pressure. The international financial system amplifies this power. By the 1990s, over 95% of international capital served speculation rather than productive investment. With $1 trillion moving daily in speculative markets, investors hold virtual veto power over governments. Clinton's 1993 abandonment of campaign promises exemplifies this. With $150 billion in Treasury securities traded daily, investors could instantly raise interest rates by selling bonds, neutralizing proposed social spending. What's emerging is de facto world government serving corporate interests through NAFTA, WTO, IMF, and World Bank. These institutions centralize power in deliberately opaque systems. The World Bank calls this technocratic insulation, ensuring corporate-aligned technocrats make decisions beyond public reach. The consequences are stark. Since the mid-1970s, virtually all wealth has flowed to top brackets. Families work 15 weeks more yearly than 20 years ago with stagnating incomes. Post-2008, 95% of recovery gains went to the top 1%. As The Economist stated, policy is insulated from politics. You can vote for anyone. Economic policy remains constrained within neoliberal parameters. Meaningful change comes from organized communities, not famous leaders. Martin Luther King could give speeches because SNCC workers and freedom riders had prepared the ground through brutal struggle. This erasure is deliberate, making people believe only great men create change, when it's always communities working together. Effective resistance requires integrating environmental, labor, racial justice, and anti-war movements into interconnected networks. As corporations globalize production to undermine standards, international solidarity becomes essential. When Daimler-Benz threatened German work standards by moving to Alabama, or Caterpillar used Brazilian plants to break Illinois strikes, they demonstrated how capital mobility requires worker solidarity across borders. Alternative media provides crucial infrastructure. Listener-supported radio and independent outlets offer spaces where people can connect and develop alternative conceptions beyond corporate-controlled narratives. The path forward isn't through electoral politics alone. It's through rebuilding popular institutions like labor unions, community organizations, and cooperative networks. The machinery of power depends on our compliance, our labor, our acceptance of manufactured reality. When enough people withdraw compliance and build alternatives together, the machinery stops. Every significant advance in human freedom came from organized people demanding it.